The IAEA's resolution has drawn swift responses from Iran. Tehran has shut down two of the agency's cameras at one site. The IAEA Director General says the Islamic Republic has informed the agency that it will remove 27 cameras, but that has not been verified by Iran. Now the IAEA and the West need to be carefully watching, as Iran says that there may be more to come as an action in response to the IAEA's resolution. To Tehran, it is unacceptable to continue cooperation while the other side does not behave properly.
In response to the IAEA's unconstructive approach, Iranian officials have now decided to remove two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency from one of its nuclear sites.
And Iran now, we know in the news, is saying that they will not, if the IAEA wants to do these kind of actions, Iran will reconsider its relationship with the IAEA. And I think it is well within its right to do so.
Tehran says the two cameras had been installed voluntarily and beyond the safeguard obligations of the IAEA. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, has hit back at the accusations, saying Tehran has given accurate answers to questions posed by the IAEA, but the agency bases its reports on the information provided by the enemies of Iran. Iran had earlier warned against the consequence of the unconstructive move by the US and Europeans to disrupt negotiations to salvage the multilateral deal, officially known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran has warned that it would give appropriate response to hostile moves.
Israel is the main provocateur of this current situation. The Zionist regime is dedicated to seeing a war with Iran. They see it almost as a holy duty. And it's not only extremely dangerous and reckless, but it shows the rogue nature of the Zionist state and of its backers in Washington.
The resolution comes as a pause in the Vienna process entered its third month. Tehran blames the US and its allies, France, Britain and Germany, for failing to act constructively during the talks. Under the JCPOA, Iran accepted certain caps on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of international sanctions. The US, however, unilaterally abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed sweeping sanctions despite Tehran's full compliance with its share of obligations.
Members of the MKO terrorist group have attacked a Press TV reporter and news team in the Swedish capital, Stockholm.
Don't touch my camera.
I would really prefer if you were on that side, because we can't control the situation. Okay. And we can't control your safety.
Okay. So can we go there?
Yeah. Over there, in the corner.
Okay, we'll go
corner.
Right now then. Okay, cool.
Okay, let's now.
The news team came under attack while covering an exhibition that displayed the crimes committed by the group. The exhibition was held near the court where Iranian citizen Hamid Nouri is on trial over allegations of human rights violations back in the 90s. Iranian authorities have strongly condemned the trial, saying that evidence presented in the court was propaganda and provided by the MKO. The terror group launched a campaign of bombings and assassinations in Iran, mostly in the 1980s. The ill-famed group is currently based in Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activity. Iranian authorities say that the MKO is responsible for the death of more than 17,000 people in Iran. Israeli forces have fatally shot another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Hul. The Palestinian Health Ministry says that regime soldiers opened fire at 27-year-old Mahmoud Fayez Abu Aihur. Medical sources said six Palestinians were also wounded in clashes with Israelis on Tuesday. Witnesses said the latest episode started after Israeli troops raided a currency exchange office. Israel has recently ramped up deadly attacks on Palestinians in the occupied territories, conducting near-daily raids across the West Bank. More than 20 Palestinians, including prominent journalist Shireen Abu Akhla, have been attacked in Israeli violence since March. Let's get more on this story. Our correspondent Mona Kandil joins us from occupied Ramallah. Mona, tell us exactly what led to this person's death and what happened.
Israeli forces raided Al-Hul city that is north Al-Khalil in the occupied West Bank, and closed the main road, fired tear gas, and carried out arrests among the Palestinians. Then Israeli forces used their life rounds against Palestinians, who, of course, left their homes in order to prevent the Israeli raid to the city of Al-Hul. As you have mentioned, Israeli forces, the main reason for raiding Al-Hul, according to the Israeli military, is to storm an exchange store that, according to the Israelis, business had been accused for laundering money for terrorism. This is what the Israelis are saying. And the Israeli forces had even seized some $300,000 during this raid. The clashes erupted, and the 27-year-old Mahmoud Fayez Abu Ayyur was shot in his upper body. He was transferred to hospital, but then the Palestinian paramedics said that he succumbed to his injuries. This comes at the same time six more Palestinians were wounded during this operation. Three of them were shot by live rounds. It seems that the Israelis, every time they raid Palestinian areas, and we have to say that almost on a daily basis, Israeli soldiers raid and storm Palestinian cities, villages, towns, and refugee camps, claiming that they want to arrest Palestinians who are accused for security reasons. But this time, it's another story. They claim that the raid is in order to close this exchange business shop, and the clashes have erupted, or the fighting erupted in that area, Al-Hul, near Al-Khalil. We have also to say that in other areas in the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have raided several areas of the occupied West Bank this morning and arrested at least 11 Palestinians. Also, those Palestinians were accused for being wanted for security reasons as well.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Monica Ndil there from Occupied Ramallah. Many thanks. Moving on, China has condemned the recent move by the United States in approving a possible sale of ship parts to Taiwan, urging Washington to scrap the plan.
The U.S. should abide by the One China principle, and the three Sino-U.S. joint communiques cancel the aforementioned Taiwan arms sale plans, stop all sales of weapons to Taiwan, and U.S.-Taiwan military communications. China will continue to take resolute and strong measures to defend its own sovereignty and security interests.
Chinese officials said the move could damage or would damage China's sovereignty and security interests. He also warned of serious detrimental consequences of such a move on the Sino-American relations. His comments come one day after Washington announced it had approved the $120 million sale of naval equipment, as well as logistic technical assistance to Taiwan. The Pentagon says that it has delivered the required certification, notifying Congress following the State Department's approval. This will be the fourth U.S. arms sales to the island since President Joe Biden took office. Beijing considers Taiwan as part of its territory. It accuses Washington of pushing Taipei to seek independence by expanding its military and diplomatic ties with the island. The battle for the city of Severodonetsk in eastern Ukraine is entering a crucial stage, with President Volodymyr Zelensky admitting the fate of the Donbas region is tied to who will eventually control the city.
Severodonetsk remains the epicenter of the encounter in Donbas. As a result of this day and night, already the 105th day of a full-scale war, we are defending our positions and are inflicting tangible losses to the enemy. This is a very brutal battle, very tough, perhaps one of the most difficult throughout this war. I am grateful to each and every one who is defending this direction. Largely, that is where the fate of our Donbas is being decided now.
The Ukrainian army has pulled back to the city's outskirts, but says we'll keep on fighting for as long as it takes. Vast parts of the city have been destroyed. The local mayor is accusing Russian forces of striking residential buildings. Severodonetsk is the last major city in Luhansk province still in control of the Ukrainian government. Luhansk and Donetsk from the Donbas region, which Moscow is trying to control. The Kremlin says Russian forces now control 97% of Luhansk. Pro-Russian forces held around a third of the Donbas before the beginning of the conflict in February. Johnny Miller is our correspondent, who joins us from Donetsk to tell us more. Maybe it's a good time, Johnny, for you to give us a roundup as to where things stand when it comes to Russian controlled territory, and of course what Ukraine is planning in terms of a pushback.
Well, Ukraine are putting up a very fierce resistance in this town, Severodonetsk. President Zelensky says that this town will decide the fate of Donbass. That's not quite true. Zelensky, of course, every day has to say things to encourage his soldiers to continue fighting. But there's no doubt Ukraine is really throwing everything at trying to defend this town. But it is Russia, with the air and artillery superiority, who are the more likely. Indeed, they've taken most of the town. They are the more likely to win the battle for that town. I was at the front line around Donetsk just the other day, in which I was shown across the fields the heavily fortified town of Adievka. And Ukrainians have had 8 years to dig deep these whole networks of tunnels underneath their fortifications. So it's very hard for the Russians, even with artillery and air power, to get to these Ukrainian soldiers, which is one of the reasons why it is proving so slow for Russia. And indeed, Ukraine are putting up a huge fight as well, and there will be many deaths on both sides. Let me actually take the opportunity now to tell you of some breaking news, and this will be a big story over the coming days, particularly in the UK. Two British men, Aidan Aslan and Sean Pinner, and also a Moroccan by the name of Saouden Brahim, have just been sentenced to death in the DPR. Now, these three men came to fight with the Ukrainian army, and they were captured. They've been there for a few years, and they were captured by the Russians or in the DPR in Mariupol. They've just had a trial. Now they pleaded guilty or partially pleaded guilty to some of the charges. And today, just now, Russian media anyway is reporting they've been sentenced to death. Why is that? Well, Ukraine and DPR and Russia say that they are treating with respect the POWs, the normal POWs in the Ukrainian army. Indeed, there's thousands of them here in DPR. Some are exchanged, prisoner exchanges, and the rest are kept here. And the Russians and DPR say they're being treated with respect. But these foreign mercenaries are being treated differently. Why? Because DPR has stated that they are, in fact, terrorists. They're not POWs. They are criminal terrorists who come from abroad. That's why they've been sentenced to death. POWs, of course, are not allowed to be sentenced or held unduly, but criminals are. So there'll be many people in Donetsk who will be happy with that, because these Ukrainian militias have committed a lot of atrocities that I've covered in Mariupol, for example. And of course, they've been fighting DPR soldiers for many years. But there is a very strong argument, that these soldiers, British or not, or Moroccan or not, should be treated as POWs and therefore not sentenced to death. But this will certainly be cause uproar in the United Kingdom, and something that's certainly a story that will develop over the next few days.
Thank you for that. Johnny Miller from Donetsk, we appreciate it. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
Four corporations control 90% of the baby formula market in the United States. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan writers. This article is published under the heading, The U.S. Corporate Monopolies Who Stole the Baby's Formula. Here's the story. Last October, a whistleblower sent the FDA a report detailing safety and sanitation violations at the Abbott Nutrition Factory in Sturgis, Michigan, the largest baby formula manufacturing plant in the U.S. It would be months before the FDA took action. Abbott fired the whistleblower. Four babies who had consumed formula from the plant suffered bacterial infections. Two of them died. The FDA could not conclusively link the illnesses or deaths to the plant. In February, Abbott shut down the plant and announced a voluntary recall of its Sturgis-manufactured baby formula. The FDA followed with a product warning. The life-threatening formula shortage was not due to a natural disaster or circumstances beyond Abbott's control. Rather, it is a predictable outcome of corporate greed, a cover-up, and a captured regulatory agency. Four corporations control 90% of the baby formula market in the United States. Abbott Labs, which produces Similac, leads with 40%, followed by Reckitt, which makes Enfamil and Lysol at 30% of the market. The Biden administration is facing mounting criticism for its delay in addressing the Sturgis plant's health and safety concerns and for failing to anticipate the formula shortages caused by the plant's closure. In many cases, infant formula is a vital necessity, providing life-saving nutrition for thousands of babies in the U.S., for whom breastfeeding is not possible due to allergies, immune conditions, or other situations. Parents of color are more likely to use formula in the first 3 months of an infant's life than white parents. The whistleblower report was received by the FDA in October. But the whistleblower was not interviewed until December. The whistleblower's report was released publicly last month in a House Appropriations Committee hearing chaired by Democratic Congressmember Rosa DeLauro. The report stated, lax practices, including regulatory violations, were consistently overlooked and described a pervasive fear of retaliation for those who dared to rock the boat. Following the hearing, DeLauro said in a statement, "The FDA is a regulatory agency, period. It is about time they acted like one." David Dayen, executive editor of the American Prospect, explained how these few large corporations obtain their power over the infant formula market with the help of an essential federal program, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. Quote, "The reason is that we have a program called Women, Infants, and Children, the WIC program, and about half of all formula passes through that program and goes to poor families. It's very well-intentioned. The government gets very large discounts for purchasing formula and getting it to poor families. But each state does a competitive bidding process with a formula company. And in exchange for those volume discounts, they get market exclusively. So what you end up having is these little monopolies in all 50 states, unquote. Formula is critical for the proper nutrition of many babies, but is generally considered less beneficial than breastfeeding. The Lancet Medical Journal issued a comprehensive series on the benefits of breastfeeding in 2016, finding that the deaths of 823,000 children and 20,000 mothers each year could be averted through universal breastfeeding, along with economic savings of $300 billion. The series confirms the benefits of breastfeeding in fewer infections, increased intelligence, probable protection against overweight and diabetes, and cancer prevention for mothers. Breast milk, the series concludes, makes the world healthier, smarter, and more equal. David Dayan, in his book, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power, describes how the U.S. regime has bullied countries in the global south that try to promote breastfeeding over formula. At a 2018 meeting of the UN-affiliated World Health Assembly, Ecuador's proposed resolution to protect, promote, and support breastfeeding was gutted by the U.S. delegation, which threatened to withhold aid to any nation opposing the U.S. stance. The U.S. delegates, Dayan writes, were operating on behalf of the $70 billion deeply concentrated global baby formula industry. After signing a long-delayed consent decree with the FDA, Abbott is expected to reopen its Sturgis plant as soon as this weekend, potentially alleviating the worst of this crisis by the end of July. Meanwhile, this corporate formula cartel profiting off babies' bellies while feeding at the public trough must be reined in, constrained by effective regulation and empowered consumers.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Today we listen to the speech of Hujjatul Islam Salim Yusuf Ali.
Ma'mun al-Rashid was one of the Abbasid Khulafa. He was somebody who, just like his forefathers, they were not people of God. They were people of the dunya. They were pleasure seekers. They were very keen on living the life. They were very keen on having power over others. So why would the Imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa Rida, in a way associate himself? Why would he agree to become the Waliul Ahd? And if we understand some points about this, we can understand more about the Imam's life, inshallah. But I want to first introduce this concept, which is known as soft power versus hard power. I think you probably have heard this term before. Sometimes it's used as like soft war, or you could say hard war. What is the difference between these? Hard power is when you force somebody to do something. You know, imagine that, you know, like you have a donkey, so you put a carrot in front of it. And you say, that, okay, you have to walk and you have to go to a certain place. And if it doesn't go where you want to, then you take a stick and you beat the donkey. That's an exercise of hard power. Soft power is different. Soft power is where you want to use someone for your purposes. So by attacking them and beating them and doing things, you know, in an open way, then they're not going to go the way that you want. You want to use them, but for your purposes. So what do you use? You use subtlety. You use different ways of, you know, kind of tricking them and getting them to do what you want to do. Okay, this is something that we should all be familiar with. Why? Because we have an enemy who is the shaitan. And you know that shaitan rarely uses hard power tactics in order to come and trick us. Right? How often have you had shaitan come and threaten you, you know, with like, you know, a vision of the hellfire? Right? It doesn't happen typically to most people. In fact, shaitan rarely even appears to most people in his original form. But what does he use? What techniques does shaitan use? It's a very interesting topic to study and to learn about. And after all, it's something that it's one of the most important things to learn about, that what techniques does the enemy use in order to swerve us away from being righteous and being good believers. In the Quran, Allah describes the shaitan, for example, as using false promises. Look, the shaitan will present things which are evil and make them look as if they're good and inviting and attractive. The shaitan will distract somebody from their purpose. And when they're distracted, then he will get them to swerve away from what they're, and forget about what their whole purpose was all about. Now, Ma'mun al-Rashid, who was the Khalifa during the last 5 years of the Imam's life, he was somebody who was very skilled in the dark arts of the shaitan. And he was in a position where he had to gain power over the people, and he saw that the only way he could do that was by making Imam Ridha alayhi salam somewhat of an ally, making Imam Ridha somehow join him. But how could he do it in a way where Imam Ridha wouldn't become the Imam? He still wanted to hold power. He wanted to use the Imam. He wanted to make sure that, you know, the Shias and those who were supporting the Imam, that they wouldn't attack him, because he knew that his government was weak. So what does he use? He uses soft power techniques. He needs the Imam, but he wants to use him and sort of try to almost trick him and trick his followers and trick the people in general. Now the Imam alayhi salam, of course, is ma'asum. We heard it in this hadith of the Prophet, where the Prophet says in the dream of Imam's father, he says that your son, yusibu wa la yukhtib, your son will always do isabatul haq. He will always arrive at the truth. He won't make an error. The Imam was gifted with nurullah, insight. He wasn't fooled with politics and with games. So Ma'mun al-Rashid, when he comes to the Imam and he says that, you know, he sends the message, okay, I want you to be the Khalifa. That's the approach that he takes. Now, why don't you come and you be the Khalifa? Now, what is the response of the Imam? It's very interesting. The Imam alayhi salam tells him that, well, Ma'mun, if being a Khalifa is something that is appointed by Allah, and you are the Khalifa right now, then it's not your right to take that position and to gift it to somebody else, because after all, it's something from Allah. And if it's not from Allah, then what right do you have to go and give it to somebody else? You see, what is he doing here? He's not telling Ma'mun directly everything that he knows about him, and he's not revealing to him everything that he knows about his agenda. But indirectly, he's telling Ma'mun al-Rashid that you know and I know that truly leadership in the ummah is not something which is determined by the people. It's not for somebody to stand and say that, okay, because I have the power, I inherited it from my father and from my brother, and I won the politics and I won out the political game, therefore I have a right to exercise power. That's not the way things work. It's something from Allah. And the Imam alayhi salam is telling him that, I know this game that you're playing right here. Later, the Imam Ali Islam accepts to be the Wali al-Ahad, the one who's sort of next in line. Now, Ma'mun is never successful in tricking the Imam. The Imam is very aware. But what about the Shias? When they see that the Imam alayhi salam is aligning himself supposedly, and he's joining the government of the enemy, what are they supposed to say? What are they supposed to do? This is where the Shias were tested. They were tested to see that when your fundamental, one of your core beliefs about the Imam is that he is ma'asum, he will not make an error. When you see him doing something which brings a question to your mind, what are you going to do? Are you going to be somebody who breaks off from the Imam? Or are you going to have firm faith that what the Imam does is correct? And are you going to seek clarification? One of the amazing things we see in history, brothers and sisters, is that those people who accepted the imamah of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, they stayed with Imam Ridha alayhi salam until he became a shaheed. And they stayed with his son. And they stayed with his son, and finally all the way to the imam of the time. We don't find groups splitting away from Imam Ridha alayhi salam. Imam Ridha, those who were with him, they stuck with him till the end. This is one of the amazing miracles of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. And it had to do with the strategy that he took. The Shia at his time, they were tested, but they passed the test. One of the really interesting examples we have of this is where Abu Salat, one of the companions of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, he goes to him and he says that, Imam, people are talking. Now that you've accepted this position, they're saying that before we thought that the Imam alayhi salam was zahid from the dunya. We thought that he was staying away from it. He had no interest in it. But now we're realizing that maybe it was the case, or we're thinking that maybe it's the case that no, that was just by chance that the dunya stayed away from him. But now he's thinking, na'udhu billah, then maybe the dunya is coming to him. What response can we give them? So what does the Imam do? He lays it out for them. He says that, Abu Salt, you should know that I was in a position where I had a choice between two things. One of them was to be killed. The other one was to accept this position and to see what I can do with it. How can I use this position for good? And I took as an example, and there's an example in the Quran for you which you can refer to, which is the example of Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam. Because Nabi Yusuf, and then the Imam Islam quotes from them in the Quran, the Nabi Yusuf was in a position where he told the leader at the time, the leader of Egypt, he says that, make me be the one who is in charge of the treasuries of the earth. I want to be in charge. Because I am somebody who is knowledgeable and I am somebody who is capable. So you see, Nabi Yusuf alayhi salam was part of a government of shirk. But he made use of that position to spread the word of Allah. And that was my position as well too. I had to choose between the lesser of two evils. And it's because of that, it's not something out of my own choice that here I am, na'udhu billah, trying to profit from the dunya, that I've changed my stance or anything like that. So the Shias, with these types of guidance from the Imam, they remain firm in their position. They knew that the Imam alayhi salam was doing what he did, and he was there for a purpose.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Kareem Adi Ali. حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد
أمير المؤمنين صلي على محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
عليه. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson has retained the support of most of his colleagues, but found himself in a much weaker position after 148 Conservative MPs voted to oust him from Downing Street. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's deputy political editor, Rowena Mason. The piece is titled, Boris Johnson Wins No Confidence Vote Despite Unexpectedly Large Rebellion. In Britain, Prime Minister Boris Johnson was clinging to his premiership on Monday night, 6th of June, after 148 of his MPs voted to oust him from Downing Street in a ballot that exposed potentially fatal rifts within his party. The Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, won the support of 211 MPs, but 41% of his party voted to get rid of him, with many citing his lack of repentance over the Partygate scandal and the public's loss of trust in his leadership. It was the worst verdict on a sitting prime minister by their own party in recent times. Although Boris Johnson and his allies claimed the vote as a victory, many Conservative MPs, including some of his supporters, believe the attempted coup is the beginning of the end of his three-year premiership. With so many of his party having voted against him, the Prime Minister has effectively lost his majority support in Parliament, with the risk that his government is paralysed. Johnson is theoretically safe from another leadership challenge for a year under the rules of the 1922 committee. But Theresa May was forced to leave office just 6 months after winning a confidence ballot, having been terminally damaged despite winning by 200 votes to 117. The proportion of MPs who voted against Boris Johnson is even greater than the votes against Theresa May in 2018 and Margaret Thatcher in 1990. Margaret Thatcher resigned just a week later. Speaking after the result, Boris Johnson insisted it was an extremely good, positive, conclusive, decisive result that would allow him to move on to unite and focus on delivery. He also claimed he had won a far greater mandate from colleagues than he did in his 2019 leadership election, although critics cast doubt on that claim. Johnson also declined to rule out calling a snap election, although he said he was not interested in that idea. Nadeem Zahawi claimed Boris Johnson had won handsomely, and he hoped the result would draw a line under the speculation from the media and the Twitterati, leading to a united party. The Education Secretary also claimed that Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, would be punching the air at the result. James Cleverly, the Foreign Office Minister, called it a comfortable and clear win for Boris Johnson, while the MP for Lichfield, Michael Fabricant, said the result was a lot better than he had feared. However, rebel MPs said Johnson should quit for the good of the party and the country. Sir Roger Gale, one of Boris Johnson's leading critics, said a Prime Minister of honour should realise he had lost the support of a sizeable number of his MPs. He suggested rebels would continue to oppose Boris Johnson remaining as Prime Minister. The scale of the rebellion means some government ministers and aides must have voted against Boris Johnson in the secret ballot while remaining publicly supportive. One former cabinet minister said he believed Johnson could soon face other attempts to oust him if the Tories lose in two by-elections on 23rd of June, or the Prime Minister is found by a parliamentary inquiry to have misled the House of Commons. The role of the Chief Whip will be key, he said. It will be his role to tell the Prime Minister he has lost his cabinet. Keir Starmer, the leader of the Labour Party, said the Conservative Party believes the British public now have no right to expect honest politicians, while Ed Davey, the Liberal Democrat leader, said Tory MPs have narrowly voted to keep a lawbreaker and a liar in No. 10 Downing Street. The confidence vote was triggered early on Monday morning after more than 54 Tory MPs, 15% of the total, submitted no-confidence letters to Sir Graham Brady, chair of the 1922 committee that represents backbenchers. Boris Johnson had embarked on a last-minute bid to win over colleagues, but a number of Tory MPs said they were surprised by the lack of effort put into the operation. The rebels started the day thinking that Johnson was certain to win the vote convincingly, but became increasingly emboldened after the resignation of John Penrose as No. 10's anti-corruption czar and a critical statement from Jeremy Hunt, a possible leadership contender. Anyone who believes our country is stronger, fairer and more prosperous when led by Conservatives should reflect that the consequence of not changing will be to hand the country to others who do not share those values. Today's decision is change or lose. I will be voting for change, Jeremy Hunt said. Announcing that he would quit, John Penrose called on Boris Johnson to stand down too, accusing the Prime Minister of failing to address the broader and very serious criticisms contained in Sue Gray's report into Downing Street parties. John Penrose said the only fair conclusion to draw from Sue Gray's report was that you have breached the fundamental principle of the ministerial code, a clear resigning matter. Jesse Norman, a former Treasury minister, also published an excoriating letter saying that Boris Johnson had presided over a culture of casual lawbreaking at No. 10 Downing Street in relation to COVID. For Johnson to describe himself as vindicated by last month's Gray report was grotesque, he said, adding that breaching the Northern Ireland Protocol would be foolhardy and almost certainly illegal, while the policy of deporting asylum seekers to Rwanda was ugly. A string of Scottish Tory MPs, including leader Douglas Ross and John Lamont, who resigned as a ministerial aide, also said they voted against Boris Johnson. Some MPs hardened their resolve against the Prime Minister after he gave a defiant speech to the 1922 committee late on Monday afternoon, suggesting he would take the same decision again in relation to holding leaving dues in No. 10 during lockdown. He also blamed the media-driven focus on the leadership of the Conservative Party and tried to turn the debate onto Brexit by claiming a vote against him would lead to a hellish Groundhog Day about rejoining the EU single market. Let us refuse to dance to the tune of the media. Let us refuse to gratify our opponents by turning in on ourselves, he said. Let's show this country that We understand that this is a moment to unite and serve. If we can do that, then believe you me, whatever they may say about me, I will lead you to victory again, and the winners will be the people of this country. After the meeting, a Conservative source briefing in support of the Prime Minister also played down the significance of the Partygate furore that has enraged the public. But one of the first MPs to leave the meeting, arch-Brexiter Steve Baker, took a very different view. He told reporters that it was a very, very sad day, but he felt he had no choice but to vote against the Prime Minister. Steve Baker added, "For me, although this is an incredibly difficult moment, I can't move past the requirement to have, at the very top of the government, a culture of compliance with laws," he said. "I told the Prime Minister that if he broke the law, he'd have to go. He clearly broke the law, he has clearly acquiesced in the law being broken, and so I must keep my word."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom has a long history among Muslim clerics. This is the speech of the leader of the Islamic Ummah on January 13, 2020, by Imam Khamenei, in a meeting with the officials of the Martyrs Who Were Clerics Commemoration Congress. The best means for inviting to the good is through action. Action in the area of inviting to do good. Therefore, entrance into the area of jihad is a clear, definite responsibility for religious scholars and Muslim clerics. There are no doubts about this. A person who withdraws from the field of jihad must know that this field is the foundation. Fortunately, this spirit is present among our honorable clerics. Some individuals have listed these martyrs. The late Amini, may God bestow paradise on him, the author of Al-Qadir, wrote a book named The Martyrs of Virtue, in which he listed the martyred religious scholars throughout history. Of course, he did not list all of them. He was able to find some of them. He listed the martyred religious scholars from the 4th and 5th centuries onward. He did not list the ones before that. There are also individuals who were martyred or who fought in the area of jihad, but who did not achieve martyrdom. But they did jihad in the way of God. Their names have not been mentioned in such books. Well, this is an honorable culture of the Muslim clerics, and I hope that this spirit and this way will continue, God willing.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I advise the dear friends and brothers who organize these commemoration congresses to not look at these congresses as being an end in themselves. They are a means. In addition to these commemoration congresses, many other actions must also be done. Finding the right method for such work requires thinking together. Individuals who are intellectuals and who are interested in culture and art should sit together and find the various ways to do this. As I mentioned before, remembering their names, publishing their photos, biographies and wills, and explaining the circumstances in which they entered into jihad are very important tasks. These must be published, and I hope that everyone will benefit from the spiritual lessons to be learned from those great personages. I hope that God will bless you and make you successful and help you to do what is necessary in this regard. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.